It's tempting when we talk about the return of Christ to really obsess over the details. You know, there was a whole very successful line of books, the Left Behind series. I'm sure some of you probably at least have saw them, maybe read them. That's all about these end time events. And it's really easy to kind of obsess over the details and think about that. And over the years, there's been no shortage of preachers that the only thing they've really talked about most of the time has been this return of Christ. That just, when I was doing my research for this, it's very easy to find websites that will just, that are just kind of crazy out there. It's just, you know, I was joking with Derek, you go on there and you're just like, oh, wow. You know, it's real easy to come across those things and go, wow, what am I supposed to take away from this? But Jesus, I believe in this passage here, his point in saying these things is not to give us an itinerary of things that are going to happen leading up to his return. When we look for his return, it's not supposed to give us a checklist. We check off all these things. We put dates beside them. And then we say, all right, now it's time for Jesus to come back. I think his emphasis through this passage here is how his disciples, those of us who are following him with our whole heart, how we're supposed to live and act as we look forward to that. But he does give us some really interesting information that we want to try to understand as best we can. We're going to be looking at Mark chapter 13. I'm going to be talking about verse 24 through the end of the chapter, but I want to read kind of most of his discourse here. So let's start back maybe at verse 5 of chapter 13 of Mark. And Jesus began to say to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. Many will come in my name, saying, 'I am he,' and will mislead many. When you hear of wars and rumors of war, do not be frightened. Those things must take place, but that is not the end, not yet the end. For nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will also be famines. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. But be on your guard, for they will deliver you to the courts, and you will be flogged in the synagogues, and you will stand before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them. The gospel must first be preached to all the nations. When they arrest you and hand you over, do not worry beforehand about what you are to say, but say whatever is given to you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but is the Holy Spirit. Brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child, and children will rise up against parents and have them put to death. You will be hated by all because of my name, but the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it should not be, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one who is on the housetop must not go down or go in to get anything from his house, out of his house. And the one who is in the field must not turn back to get his coat. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. But I pray that it may not happen in the winter, for those days will be a time of tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the creation, which God created until now and never will. Unless the Lord had shortened those days, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those he chose, he shortened the days. And then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'Behold, he is there,' do not believe him, for false Christ and false prophets will arise and will show signs and wonders in order to lead astray, if possible, the elect. But take heed, behold, I have told you everything in advance." Derek preached on that last week, and if you weren't here, you might want to download it. I'm not going to comment on it, but I wanted to have the context. Let's continue in verse 24, where I'm going to start this morning. "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. And they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send forth the angels and will gather together his elect from the four winds and from the farthest end of the earth to the farthest end of heaven. Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day or hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Take heed, keep on the alert, for you do not know when the appointed time will come. It's like a man away on a journey, who upon leaving his house and putting his slaves in charge, assigning to each one his task, also commanded the doorkeeper to stay on the alert. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, whether in the evening, at midnight, or when the rooster crows, or in the morning, in case he should come suddenly and find you asleep. What I say to you, I say to all, be on the alert. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for this time that you've given us to come together, to lift up songs to you, to pray to you, to open up your word and be taught by you, Lord. Lord, I pray that the things that I say will point all of us in the right direction. I pray that your spirit would teach us, that anything I say that's off base, that you'll just remove it from people's ears and their minds, Lord. Help us to understand what you've taught us in these words. And we pray these things in your name. Amen. So, some pretty intense language here. I'm not going to lie. There's some things that that can be a bit scary, that, you know, can be confusing. But let's kind of walk through this and get some of the context that we're talking about here. One of the things that we have to look at, or one of the big questions for this passage, is what is Jesus actually referring to? He's saying these words right before he goes to the cross. We're in Passover week, probably Wednesday, before he goes to the cross. You know, he's about to be crucified just a couple of days later, then be resurrected on Sunday, spend some time with his followers after his resurrection, and then ascend to heaven. So we're kind of like, well, what is he talking about here? Well, one thing that we have to keep in mind is that about 40 years after the events of the crucifixion, the life of Jesus, was the first Jewish-Roman war. It took place from 66 to 73 AD. You have to understand that Israel was occupied by the Romans, and then there was this great revolt during this period where there was just tremendous conflict between the Jewish people and the Romans that were over them. This war went on from 66 to 73 AD. Kind of one of the pivotal moments was in AD 70, where the Romans put the city of Jerusalem under siege. Part of this was that the temple, you know, the center of their worship, was destroyed in 70 AD. But it wasn't just the temple. The whole city was decimated. Just the temple, and the temple we're talking about is Herod's temple, or the second temple, which was built about 90 years earlier to replace Solomon's temple that we read about in the Old Testament, which had been destroyed several hundred years before that. Like I said, the city of Jerusalem was utterly destroyed. They left just a few pieces of the city up, like a few of the towers and parts of the wall, just so that when people came by, they would see that Jerusalem used to be a great city, but that Rome had destroyed it. Josephus, the Jewish historian of that period, said that over 1 million people were killed, including women and children. Other numbers I've seen are lower than that, but that's what he was claiming. The Jews, even to this day, commemorate this event. It's called Tisha B'Av, which means the ninth of Av, which is one of their months. And it's a somber occasion where they commemorate not just the destruction of the temple, but just the loss of their city as a whole. And as we've been talking about through our house fellowships, we recognize the importance of the animal sacrifices in the Jewish law. It was how they covered their sins, looking forward to the time that Jesus came. In the past almost 2,000 years since the temple was destroyed, there have been no daily sacrifices. So this key part of their religion has not been going on for almost 2,000 years now. So this is a huge event in the life of the Jewish people. So in these verses, in the first few verses here, we see a lot of really intense prophetic language. It echoes of Daniel and of Amos you know, Joel and Ezekiel and Isaiah, and even later on we see some similar language in Revelation. This prophetic language, one of the things with prophecy is that there's often a short-term fulfillment and there's a long-term fulfillment. The short-term fulfillment is usually limited in scope, and the long-term fulfillment is complete, a much larger and more significant in scope. So we, a couple of examples of that would be the Psalms of David. You know, a lot of David's Psalms, the events that he talks about in there were fulfilled in his life, but they were to be fulfilled in even greater sense in the Messiah. And then also we see in Isaiah, there's a lot of, you know, there's verses in Isaiah that he wrote concerning the birth of Jesus, which were fulfilled in a limited capacity during the life of Isaiah, but then in a complete capacity in Jesus. So we have to see that prophecy a lot of times has kind of a double fulfillment. And it's understandable that Jesus' disciples probably thought that his return, he would return immediately, especially once they saw the temple being destroyed. They had to be thinking, wow, okay, Jesus should show up any time now. So it would be understandable for them to think that. But we have to think about these verses. There's some that will say that only the destruction of Jerusalem is in context here. And some that would say it's only the second coming of Christ that is in context here. But I think in the view of this chapter, both events are in view. The destruction of Jerusalem and also the future return of Christ. The conquest of Jerusalem is theologically tied to the end time events, but not necessarily chronologically tied. In verse 24, let's start going through these verses here. In verse 24, it says, the sun will be darkened. Just a few days later, after these words were spoken, Jesus would be on the cross. And we see in the passage that the sun is darkened. When these verses could be referring to a similar event to that, it could also be indicating that at the time of the end times that the sun itself will fail. You know, that could be a possible, what he's talking about here, or that merely that we wouldn't see the sun. In verse 25, it talks about stars falling. In the first sense, in kind of a limited sense, it could be metaphorical. It could be referring to the Roman and Jewish princes that were in power at the time that fell during this great war and tribulation. Many of them died, lost their power. But in the second fulfillment, I think it's a lot more literal. I think that when we see the return of Christ, there will be stars that fall, because that second fulfillment is much larger in scope and significance. Now, those of us who've had probably fifth grade science know that stars are a lot bigger than Earth. You know, our sun is hundreds of times bigger than us. So it's not that the stars will literally fall to Earth, because that's an impossibility. But it could appear that they do. You know, we see meteors and we call them falling stars. But also, there's this idea later on that verse, it says that the powers that are in the heavens will be shaken. These powers, some of the commentators believe this refers to things like gravity that holds our planets in orbit. And what if gravity is just gone? What if, you know, the sun is our center of gravity in our solar system? If everything in the heavens changes what it normally does, it will look like stars move in strange ways. I'm not saying that that's exactly what I think it would be. The thing is that things will be happening in the sky that are not normal. It will appear as if the stars are falling. Verse 26. He's quoting here from Daniel chapter 7. I'm going to flip back there. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I'm going to read 13 and 14. So Daniel 7, 13 and 14 says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. This is clearly a prophecy referring to the Son of Man, Jesus. And so it's quoted here in verse 26. So in Daniel, this coming with the clouds is Jesus going to the Father. And one view is that this may be referring to Jesus' enthronement, his vindication during the first century. The Jewish people had rejected Jesus. They said, "You're not the Messiah." You know, they killed him. But you could see how this destruction of Jerusalem could be like, no, Jesus was the real deal, and you missed it. But probably the most common view is that this passage refers to his return, his second coming, that he will come in the clouds. The word that's translated as coming can also mean going, and so that's why there could be some... It just means moving, doesn't necessarily give direction. So it could mean, as in Daniel, that he's going to be with the Father. It could be that he's coming here. I told you these passages were a little bit difficult. So you have to forgive me if I'm kind of squirming a little bit. But so we have this idea that it's going to be a huge event, that things will be in the sky that are not normal. Every eye will see Jesus as we see in other passages. Verse 27, it refers to the angels, which are often associated with judgment. And then he uses this idiom, the four winds, which is just a way of saying that from all over the earth. The four winds could be north, east, west, and south. And so it could be, the idea is that his followers will come to him from all over. It's not going to be from one place. It'll be from all over. So let's move on here. Let's go to verse 28. Now learn from the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. If you were to walk outside, especially if you're walking around campus, some of the trees and everything around here are already starting to bloom. Now, we may have snow next week, for all we know. That's kind of one of the things about being in Georgia. But it's this indication that spring is just around the corner. Summer is coming. In much the same way, that's the period of time that Jesus was saying these words. It was just before Passover, which occurs very early in spring every year. And so remember, he's on the Mount of Olives here. This is the perfect illustration for the time, because he was teaching on the Mount of Olives, which is known for its fig tree. Some of these fig trees could grow 20 to 30 feet tall. And they would have already started showing some sprouts, but they would not have the figs on them yet, because that doesn't come till later in the year. So this was just like him saying, you see this fig tree? It's kind of like that. Another great illustration that Jesus uses here. I was going to try to grab a flowering plant and bring it in and show it to you, but I missed it on my way in. And then in verse 29, he says, even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that he is near, right at the door. And as we talked about in one of our house fellowships this past week, the word that's translated he is actually neutral, so it could be he or it. So whether it's saying that he is near or it, referring to his return, is near, the idea is the same. That ever since the incarnation, men have been living in the last days, that his return is imminent, even though you're like, well, it's been 2,000 years, but it's still imminent. It could happen at any moment. And that's why the rest of what he says here is important. Verse 30, this is another verse that people have struggled with for quite a long time. It says, truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away till all these things take place. Now, to our ears, that would mean, okay, this generation, which would be like the group of people born around the same time who are currently alive. So if we were to take it at its like first meaning, like what we normally would think of, when it says this generation, these people are thinking, well, man, a lot of us will probably still be around when he comes back. You know, we'll still be alive. And in some ways, that's correct, because the destruction of the temple happened some 40 years later, and that is obvious that, or it'd be understandable that a lot of those people were still alive when that happened. So you can understand, it's like, wow, Jesus said these things would happen, and wow, but now they're happening. Kind of a secondary take on that would be that the generation of people who see these signs would still be alive when he returns. But I think probably a better understanding this, at least in the long term, is that the word generation can also be translated into a distinct group of people. as it's done in, elsewhere in Scripture and in other writings. And what he's referring to, I believe, is that he's saying that Israel, as a group of people that is recognizable, will still be a group of people that you can identify and say, these are Jewish people. And you have to understand how big a deal that was, because Jewish people, if you read the nation of Israel, the Jewish, their life had, as a people, has been difficult. You know, you know, we think back to the Holocaust, you know, well, that's been a lot of their existence. They're constantly been attacked. They've constantly been without a home. They've been dispersed into all these different nations. And so it would be understandable that they would just kind of blend in to the different nations that they were sent into. But Jesus says that this generation, this group of people, will still be a people, which 2,000 years later, they're still a people. And so it's, just the fact that Israel exists is a fulfillment of prophecy all these years later. Back in 1948, Israel became a state, became a country. Excuse me. They actually had a land. They had borders. And if you watch the news lately, there's still a lot of conflict around those borders. But there were a lot of people who in 1948, when they saw Israel become a state, they're like, whoa, something's going on here. Because that was a big deal. And many understood, they tried to apply this fig tree parable to that event. They tried to say, oh, Israel now is a state. They're the fig tree that's starting to show leaves. And so they started the clock on these events. And they tried to, the interpretation was that the generation of people who saw Israel become a state would then see the return of Christ. And a lot of times in the biblical sense, generation is 40 years. And so they actually like were setting dates. They were like, all right, it's 1948. By 1988, we're going to see Jesus. And there were all these things that built up around it. I mean, it was intense. You know, I was a little kid, so I don't remember a whole lot of it. But if you do a little study and you're like, wow, you know, some people were really convinced about this. And when that didn't happen, because Jesus didn't come back in 1988, or we're all in trouble. But I think I can say confidently that he did not return in 1988. But you can imagine if you're one of those people who are thinking, boom, Jesus is coming back, and then he didn't, what would that do to you? So I think a lot of believers were really confused and disillusioned by the whole thing, because they thought they had it figured out. And somehow Jesus knew that we were going to do stuff like that. So in verse 32, he says, but of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. No one knows. This verse here is unique to the Gospel of Mark. You don't see it in the other Gospels that recount this story. Some would say that the word for know could be translated not to be made known. So maybe this was information that was not for Jesus to share, that he knew it, but he wasn't supposed to share it. I guess that's a possibility, but I think there's probably a better explanation for it. Jesus, we know, was fully God and was fully man. It was not like he was 50-50 or anything like that. But what Jesus did when he became a man is that he voluntarily limited himself. What are some examples? In Luke 2:52, where it talks about Jesus growing up, he was a little kid and he got old, you know, as he grew older, it says that he increased in wisdom and stature. Now, how can God increase in wisdom? But he was limited himself. It just doesn't mean that he wasn't God, that it doesn't in any way limit his deity. But he was like every other little kid that grows up and increases in what they understand. They also get taller. So, but he grew up like any other child would. John Wesley says that as a man, Christ was no more omniscient than omnipresent. Omniscient meaning knowing everything. Omnipresent meaning being everywhere. As a man, Jesus was only in one place at one time. Now, that may be an oversimplification, but I think it conveys the idea that in the same way that Jesus wasn't everywhere all the time as God is, he also didn't know everything in the same way that God does. Now, the Son, the idea of Jesus as the Son and Jesus as man could get a little bit confusing. But I think the idea that we have to understand is that Jesus voluntarily limited what he knew. There were times that he had incredible insight that was given to him, that there's no other way that he can know it other than by God. But there were also a lot of things where he limited himself because he was a man. The important thing I think Jesus is trying to tell us here is that we're not to strive to figure out exact dates. Rather, we're to be alert. We're not supposed to, kind of a bad illustration, but we're not supposed to sit on the rooftops looking for Jesus' return and ignore everything else that goes on in our life or that should be going on. But I have to think about all those people that heard Jesus say this, and then some 40 years later, Jerusalem is taken over. If they took to heed the words that we read earlier in this chapter to just get out of town as quickly as possible, they were probably in a lot better position than the ones that stuck around and waited for the city to be taken over. Those who listened to him then were better off, and those of us who listen to him now will be better off. Let's keep going. Verse 33. Take heed, keep on the alert, for you do not know when the appointed time will come. Back in Matthew 25, there's three parables about being alert or being watchful. The parable of the 10 virgins, the parable of the talents, the parable of the sheep and the goats. All three of those have this idea of being watchful and alert. So he reiterates that in a slightly different way here at the end of chapter 13. He talks about a man and his house. This would probably be a wealthy man that had people that took care of his house, even when he wasn't there. So the idea of a house, you also have to understand, means a lot of times a whole family or a household. It's not just talking about the physical structure of the house. It's talking about everything that's in it and goes on in it. The people that he put in charge of this house had a responsibility for not allowing just anybody to come into the house. They also had a responsibility not to let things go out of the house that were not supposed to go out of the house. Could you imagine going away and the folks who were taking care of your house said, "Oh, well, we gave all your stuff away while you were gone because we thought that'd be a good idea." That would probably not make the homeowner very happy. But the other thing is that they have to observe all the correspondence, you know, any letters that are coming in and out. They have to take care of all the business and do things in the way that the master wanted them done. You could understand that he would give instructions for that. Hopefully you're beginning to see how this is applicable to us, that it's applicable to our own lives and to our own minds and to our own hearts, but also to that of the church. And I'll explain a little bit about that in just a minute. Verse 35, he tells them that they should be doing the right things, and he lists the four watches of the night, and these would be the Roman watches of the night, knowing that Mark had a more Roman audience in his writings. But what are we waiting for? We're waiting for the master to come home in these verses. But for us, it could be our death when we are face to face with Jesus, or it could be his return, neither of which we know when are going to happen. Verse 36, he tells them to not be asleep. If the people who are responsible for the house are asleep, they're really putting the house at risk. There was no ADT security system at the time. It was up to people to take care of their house. So how do we interpret this parable for us? Jesus, having ascended into heaven, is the man away from his house, his family. Believers, those of us who are called by his name, I think we're collectively his family, his household. His servants, the ones that he talks about, the servants and the doorkeeper, those are the ones who have responsibilities for that family. You know, in every group of people, in every family, in every church, there are people who have greater responsibility. And I think that's the doorkeeper. The doorkeeper has a greater responsibility for the entire household. Just as in the church, there are leaders who have greater responsibility than others for what goes on and what is taught. But everyone has work to do, and everyone has strength from the Lord to do it. Nobody gets to just hang out and wait for the master to come back. We all have assignments. And each one of us will give an account of how we exercised our responsibilities, whether they're great responsibilities or small. We're all going to have to give an account for what we did with them. Because the master will return at an unknown time. It's going to be unexpected. It's not going to be sneaky, which he talks about in other places. It's not going to be like, hey, I think Jesus is over there. No, it's going to be clear when he returns. It's not going to be hidden. With that in mind, we have to remain faithful and alert because we never know when it will be. And then in verse 37, what I say to you, I say to all, be on the alert. Every person is personally responsible. It's not like, well, that doesn't really apply to me, or I'm not one of those, and so it's not a big deal for me. What he says, and you have to remember, he's talking to a very small group of people here, of his followers, but he gives the wider application. What I'm telling you guys goes for everybody. In other words, tell everybody what I said. Some people have this idea, we don't know when Jesus is coming back, so I guess it really doesn't matter. Other people have the idea, we don't know when Jesus is coming, so we've got to figure it out. We've got to find a date. We've got to put a date on it, put it on our calendars, and then be looking forward to it. The right response is, I don't know when Jesus is coming, so I have to be alert, eager, and ready for his coming. It could be at any time, and so we have to be ready for it. This past week was, I had my birthday. I turned 36. And this, when we had house fellowship this weekend, we were getting ready to pray with a few other guys, and I said, yeah, I'm on like almost, I was like, am I officially at the midlife point? And so the next day I'm looking up on Wikipedia. It's like, what is the average life expectancy for a male in the United States? And it's gone up a little bit. I mean, apparently we're doing something right. It's actually around 77, 78. And I'm like, okay, I'm not quite there yet, but give me another year or two and I will officially hit the halfway point. And I was like, okay, well, that's kind of cool, you know. But, you know, that's just the average, you know. My grandfather on my mom's side is 86. One of my aunts on my dad's side is over 80. You know, but I've also had people in my family die younger than that. My grandmother died younger with Alzheimer's. My two step-parents passed away in their 60s. And that's just kind of sickness and health things, you know. I may not make it back to my house when I leave today. You know, some crazy guy may run a red light or something and take me out. You know, I could live a lot longer. I could live less. You know, we just don't know. That's just the uncertainty that we all live with. We don't obsess over it. Hopefully we don't obsess over it. We go forward and live the life that God's called us to, knowing that when our time is up, our time is up. But that same uncertainty exists with the return of Christ. You know, we may not finish this service. It could be, it's been 2,000 years, and there were a lot of people who were thinking Jesus would have already come by now. I think every generation has that expectation, and that's, in a lot of ways, a good thing. We should always be living as if Jesus' return is imminent, because it is. These are the last days. And, you know, again, I don't want to sound like one of the guys that you see on TV at 3 a.m., you know, preaching about these things. But in a lot of ways, it is true that we're in the last days. And we have to live like that. We have to live to where we're always alert. We're always doing the right things because, I mean, I don't want to be doing the wrong thing when he shows up. You know, You know, I don't want to be in the middle of doing the wrong thing when I die. And then I go, well, we don't really want to talk about what he was doing when he died because it was the wrong thing. And so we have to live our lives alert, not like a scared kid that's waiting for their parents to come home when they've done something wrong, but eagerly just saying, I can't wait till he gets here, because that's what everything is about, what we've been looking for. This is a tough passage. I read 10, 20 different commentaries on it, and you'll find one guy that says it exactly means this, this, and this, and you'll read another one that says it means exactly the opposite of this, this, and this. But what I try to look at is, what did Jesus want us to take away from it? And I think it's really, the other stuff is important, because all of those are signs of when he returns. But what he says is, be alert, be ready. The rest of that stuff will take care of itself, and we'll be exactly where we need to be if we're alert and ready and doing the things that he's told us to do. Do the things that we know and understand, and then do our best to understand the stuff that's harder.